Bruce Pratt here for this week's edition of Sports Lit 101. And Bruce, we've talked over the last several weeks about some terrific pieces from the collection Sporting Realities. And now we begin talking to some of the people who wrote those terrific pieces, looking at sports media. Who have we got today?
We have Brandon Mueller with us today, and he wrote the first chapter, and it really, it's going to sound to the college professor, I mean, contextualizes the whole book. It's the absolute perfect entree into the greater discussion of critical readings of the sports documentary. So, Brandon, certainly welcome to Downtown. And if you could put a little historical context on the importance of the hour-long drama and the golden age of TV and the evolution of the sports documentary.
Yeah, hi. First off, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. Just to kind of go a little bit into the chapter and how that crosses over with some of these discussions of hour-long dramas. So the thing that I started, you know, I noticed, you know, at the, you know, 15 or so years ago, all these sports documentaries popping up. And one of the things that most drew my attention was how often they were labeled as quality programming, as, you know, prestige programming. And then my research question became, why were they so often being labeled as quality program when specifically so often sports television is not discussed in those terms? It's normally, you know, not really seen as quality programming, as it were. And I found that if I wanted to answer that question of why sports TV, in the case of the documentary, was now being labeled as quality or prestige or, you know, all these various synonyms for high quality, that I needed to look at other realms of television that have more typically been labeled quality, which has normally been like the primetime drama, and particularly sectors of the primetime drama of late, particularly cable TV, premium cable TV around HBO. And what I really was discovering as part of this process is that the labeling of certain programming as quality, as being particularly prestigious, as being particularly refined, has really long roots in the industry, in that things just don't spontaneously end up being labeled as quality or refined or sophisticated or complex. Rather, it has to do with, you know, a host of industrial factors. Generally, it's the television industry wanting to signal in some sort of way its attachment to affluent crowds, affluent audiences that it can, attach then, you know, specific advertising to. And so typically what then has happened is that the crossover has been around primetime programming. And that means then particularly prestige, quote unquote, prestige programming has meant cable TV programs aimed at affluent viewers. And so in the case of the sports documentary, to understand why it was labeled as quality, had to understand this longer history of certain TV shows have been labeled as for quality audiences, and particularly here, affluent audiences, and particularly other TV programs have not gotten that label because they've been, you know, seen to attract other demographics, and so then have been excluded. And so I know you're talking on the show, for example, you know, the rural TV shows, for example, because they, you know, they weren't seen as attracting that quality demographic, we're never going to get that term.
Well, I know that Norman O'Reilly, who's the dean of the Maine Graduate School of Business and has written for years on sports branding and marketing and the like, has mentioned this in some of his work. And you bring it up that there were television shows which got great ratings, but the advertisers weren't getting what they felt was their bang for the buck. And a lot of those shows were canceled. Candid Camera, as I remember, maybe the Beverly Hillbillies. In sports, when HBO started to put these sort of quote quality documentaries together, were they looking, in your opinion, towards advertising revenue, or was it something more noble than that?
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, as HBO moved into sports. Well, I mean, sports has long been at the, you know, a big part of HBO going back. I know you had all been talking about like boxing, and, you know, HBO long had a sports slice there to its programming. But it would make sense, as it generally had this, you know, reputation it was developing over the course of, you know, the 90s and the 2000s, continuing today, of not, of being not TV, of being something different, of being more refined, more prestigious, of having that cultural capital. It would make sense that if it wanted to be involved in sports, the documentary is a place to be involved, because the documentary has a long history of having that particular level of cultural capital, in the same way that other elements of its programming do as well, the hour-long primetime dramas. And so for HBO, there's you know, specifically less about the advertising need, because HBO has long based its revenue on subscriptions rather than attracting advertisers. But in terms of attracting those subscribers, it would make sense, if you're going to have sports programming, to have programming that it felt like would align with the sensibilities of those same sorts of subscribers, who would also be, you know, attracted to its hour-long cable dramas, and it's out, and it's also, you know, the movies that it was offering as well. So, you know, it makes sense that it would see documentaries, sports documentaries, as aligning with that broader strategy of aiming at those quote unquote quality audiences. And that reinforces this idea then that HBO is involved in sports documentaries, that they're all the more prestigious.
Well, and then when ESPN comes along and Bob Lee starts 30 for 30, which created some great television, cinematic quality television, there were still fewer platforms. You know, we didn't have ESPN 1 through 2000 now, and we didn't have as many, you know, the NHL Network, what didn't exist, things that there weren't as many places to show, quote, quality television. Do you think that a lot of what went into the thinking, and we've talked to Travis Vogan a lot about ESPN, but went into their thinking in this, was that they needed to find a way to lock in a certain demographic when they weren't watching games?
Yeah, well, I mean, Travis has written a lot about, you know, sports documentaries and ESPN, and how the motivations align there, and particularly 30 for 30 coming at really this crisis point for ESPN, where ESPN, you know, reputationally long been associated with particularly like 18 to 34 year old males, and, you know, been comfortable in that sort of, you know, attachment there and all the cultural connotations that come along with that. But specifically 30 for 30 popping up around a time where ESPN was taking a lot of heat culturally and really being denigrated as being, you know, kind of a low quality programming, specifically because of things like The Decision feeling very sensationalist, this TV program where LeBron James announced his free agency special, which felt like ESPN kind of had blurred the lines of its journalistic responsibilities versus its role as providing entertainment. And so 30 for 30, even though, you know, ESPN has had generally not prioritized attracting the quality audiences in the same way as like HBO and other sorts of, you know, the premium cable channels, in this case, at that specific moment, 30 for 30 made a lot of sense, because those documentaries could help improve ESPN's tarnished reputation, where it, you know, seemed like maybe it was ethically compromised in making, you know, this sort of programming and just having, you know, talk programming. And so, yeah, I mean, for ESPN, the 30 for 30, you know, there's very, you know, as Travis has written a lot about, there was, you know, very, very intentional, you know, corporate strategizing there to burnish its reputation. And, you know, even if it wasn't going to necessarily try all the time to be like HBO or Showtime and really attach itself to that high culture reputation, that nonetheless, in the specific moment where ESPN's reputation might have dipped, 30 for 30 with these documentaries that would, you know, by attachment with, you know, renowned filmmakers, would help solidify some of that and show its willingness to go demographically in other sorts of places.
Well, I know when I first, when ESPN first went on the air, I lived two towns over from Bristol, Connecticut, and knew people that, you know, worked at ESPN, not in the broadcast end of things. And, you know, there were the monster truck pulls and the Australian rules football and other things to keep attention. And there was this sense that it was a jock network, right? That's what it was for. And as Travis has pointed out and others have pointed out, that model started to erode pretty quickly when other people were starting to do other things. Who do you think had the greatest effect on changing the documentary? Was it the original HBO commitment, or was it when 30 for 30 came around that kicked them both up a notch?
You know, that's a great question. And, you know, I think about this so much through my perspective because I'm in the classroom and I'm so often talking to 18 to 21 year olds about their viewing experiences. But when I talk to them about sports documentaries, it's almost synonymous with 30 for 30. Yeah. You know, that's basically like where sports documentaries begin and end there with them. They also are very much into documentary series, which is, you know, really been a big thing over the last few years, things like Drive to Survive on Netflix. But, you know, perhaps they've warped my perspective, but the fact that it's had such this huge ripple effect with particularly younger audiences and has really seemed to change the way they think about sport and, you know, open them to some willingness to thinking about sport history and thinking about broader cultural, socio-political questions around sport, as these documentaries are often exploring. It really makes me, you know, it's often, you know, sometimes when you're reading about ESPN and the way they promote the 30 for 30s, you know, series, it can feel like a lot of unwarranted hype, you know, the ESPN touting itself, just how amazing these documentaries are. But it really does seem to, you know, for younger audiences have really been, it feels like a, you know, this major point for the sports documentary and making it such a bigger part of the media experience. So, you know, perhaps this is recency bias, but it really does feel like the creation of the 30 for 30 series was a major moment in really making that a more familiar part of the sports media diet.
We're talking with Brandon Buehler here on Downtown. Brandon, this is Rich. I was wondering though, because as you point out in the book, the 30 for 30s make up a pretty small portion of ESPN's overall programming. Does this quality programming also then give them the license to fill much of their day when they don't have live sporting events with things like First Take and the Skip Baylesses of the world?
Yeah, well, that's very much related to that, you know, I was just talking about a second ago, where ESPN, it gets dinged a lot for that type of programming. And so very much these 30 for 30s have been a way for ESPN to say, well, we're not just that. We have this other programming too. And you can't just say that we are only Stephen A. Smith in First Take and, you know, debate programming, that we're multifaceted, layered, you know, the worldwide leader in sports, as it goes, the tagline. But I will say part of my motivation for writing this book chapter was I did start getting a little rankled a little bit when it felt like all discussions of sports media, particularly when 30 for 30 was, you know, maybe at its high point culturally, it did feel like discussions of sports media were really getting, you know, all the air was being sucked out and it was just a discussion of these sports documentaries. And, you know, for me, yeah, you know, sports media is often not good, so to say. You know, there's a lot of filler out there. But, you know, I think when we only equate quality in sports media with documentaries, you know, we can overlook a lot of what is really interesting about sports television, some of the things that can be really amazing aesthetically. So, you know, right before, you know, I called into the show, I was watching a Champions League game on TV. And it's just, you know, I watch sometimes and I'm just blown away by the way that some of these big budget productions of live sporting events can really be almost like, to use some language from the industry, like a symphony of sights and sounds, and like just the artistry to go into the camera placement and getting the perfect slow-mo replay at exactly the right time. I mean, it's, you know, can really be this just amazingly complex machinery that goes into a live event telecast. And none of that's ever really recognized within any sort of discussions of sport. We kind of take it for granted. Well, of course, you know, these things are supposed to look great. We have all these, you know, trained technical experts working on them and, you know, expect them to push the right buttons at the right times and pick the right camera at the right time. But it really could be quite amazing. And so, you know, to just talk about, well, there's good sports TV, which is the documentary, and then there's everything else, to me, felt a little simplistic because, you know, there is so much nuance there. And, you know, you can really get into discussing, you know, what's a really amazingly well-produced live event telecast versus what are ones where it looks like maybe they, you know, the budget was strained and it was produced not to the same level of quality, to use that quality terminology, that we might get from something like, you know, I mentioned this Champions League game that I was watching that people are all over the world are watching and, you know, is going to be absolutely so much money thrown at it. And you get then that really amazing symphony of sights and sounds.
Well, when you look to where we're headed, and I always hate to ask authors to prognosticate, but you have so much more background in this than any of us here. When you're looking at the future, what do you see as the newer trends, or what do you see as the general future of sports documentaries with all streaming and everything else that's in place?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're going to continue to have a large role. There have been a lot of sports streaming services launched over the past few years, or streaming services that feature sports programming. So ESPN Plus, Paramount Plus, Amazon Prime, all of these have a lot of sports within them and a lot of sports content, sports tabs, all of these sorts of things. And one of the things that's really important about sports documentaries is that relative to, for example, a live event telecast, they're cheap to produce and you can get a lot of content out of them. And so over the, you know, next 10, 15 years, as, you know, continues to be, we see, you know, sports move into the streaming space, I continue to just imagine there's going to be so much documentary content produced, and that we're going to, all these streaming services, when they launch their new streaming properties, their sports streaming properties, accompany it with a lot of documentary footage. And here, though, you know, but then that makes me think in the future, you know, when 30 for 30 launched, it was like this very hyped, well-marketed moment. It was, you know, the sports documentary was very much in the cultural zeitgeist. And there was this rare moment, there was a lot of conversation around sports documentaries. And, you know, you could take for granted, you know, a lot of other people have watched these documentaries that were premiering. As they're, you know, these streaming services fill up their space with all of these documentaries, these all or nothing series and things like Drive to Survive, you know, perhaps we might have lost a little bit of, you know, all of this quantity perhaps will reduce. It's going to be harder for a documentary to cut through the space and be in that same moment where everyone's talking about it. We do have the recent example of The Last Dance being a huge cultural moment, but so much of that was so unique that premiered during the pandemic, right at the start of the pandemic, when there is no live sporting footage for other people to, you know, for people to talk about. And so everything was kind of centered on that, but that was relatively unique. I see into the future, lots of still sports documentary footage, lots of sports documentary TV series, where there's lots and lots of hours of footage, but then fewer of them cutting through the clutter to get the same sort of conversation that we might have gotten around some of these 30 for 30s going into things like, for example, like OJ Made in America. So quantity, but not necessarily the same level of necessarily maybe water cooler talk, or however we want to define that.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Brandon. It's a great chapter, and I'm really loving the book. We're going to have some of the other authors on over the next month. But we're always interested in this kind of thing. So anytime you've got a new chapter, a book, something like that, let us know about it, and we'd love to talk to you again.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun to talk about sports documentaries in this chapter. And thanks so much for reading.
Oh, our pleasure. Our pleasure. That was Brandon Buehler. That's I tell you, his chapter in this book is really, really excellent. It's not, you know, we don't talk about things we don't like, but this one is really particularly good.
Good stuff from the book Sporting Realities.